To get direction on complicated political issues, the government often turns to an expert in a field. Whether it's serving in a cabinet position or on an advisory board, those with expertise can have a lot of sway on policy decisions. Our next guest says giving too much power to experts is actually undemocratic, and it can make everyday people feel alienated from their government. He calls for more opportunities to get people involved in making the decisions that affect their lives. Nicholas Tampio is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University in New York. He studies the history of political thought, contemporary political theory, and education policy. His piece in Eon Magazine online is titled "Treat People as Citizens." Nicholas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
I want to start talking about the role of experts, and you introduced me to a new word, new to me, in your piece called epistocracy. What is that? A rule by experts, I guess, right?
Yes, well, it's a concept coined by Jason Brennan at Georgetown University. He has a recent book called Against Democracy, but the idea goes back to Plato's Republic. And, you know, if you've read Plato's Republic, you'll know that the ideal republic is you have philosophers for kings in charge, you have guardians leading and auxiliaries below them, soldiers and farmers and merchants below them. And so it's very much a system where you put smart people in charge of the whole political order. And that idea has never gone away in Western political thought, but it got a boost in the early 20th century with this journalist named Walter Lippmann. And Walter Lippmann wrote a book called Public Opinion in 1920, which is a devastating attack on democratic politics. And his main line of attack is just saying most people don't know anything about politics. They don't have the time, they don't have the training, they don't have the concentration span. And so, you know, the notion that the people should have power is either nonsensical or dangerous. And I wrote my piece in Eon because a whole new wave of political scientists, economists, social scientists are reviving this argument. And they're using new words and new frames, new evidence, but the backbone of the argument goes back to Lippmann and Plato's Republic. And, you know, what I really want to do is just remind people why democracy is better than rule by experts.
And you write that in that new wave, there's this idea that we can use big data, a benevolent government with smart experts can give us nudges, not overtly push us in certain directions, but, you know, give us little incentives that help us make the right decisions for ourselves. How do you see that taking shape?
Yeah, well, so big data is transforming all sorts of different fields of inquiry and the notion, or all sorts of different aspects of social life. And the notion of nudging is that experts in the background can manipulate preferences so that people supposedly do the right thing. So, you know, a famous example is when you get a job, you're automatically enrolled in a healthcare plan. So you're free to opt out of it. And sometimes you have to pay a fee, but the system is designed to, you know, slot you into the good direction. And so somebody like that is Cass Sunstein, who was the head of the OMB during the Obama administration, or Richard Thaler, who was just awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. They're big into nudging. And, you know, part of what I'm trying to do in my piece is remind readers the purpose of democracy is not to make the people comfortable. It's not even necessarily to give them good outcomes. The purpose of democracy is to have people connected to their common way of life. And so it has all sorts of benefits. One, it just makes citizens smarter and more informed and more capable of speaking and articulating. So there's this notion that participating in politics educates you to just be a better person. And then there's also the question of you want a connection to the world in which you live, because if you don't, you're alienated and you just feel like these hotshots and or these brainiacs in Washington, D.C. are making all of the decisions. They don't care what you think. And, you know, if they don't care what you think and there's a celebrity on TV saying, you know, he'll speak for you, the silent majority, well, you know, you might be drawn to this charismatic figure. So, you know, I want to remind people that the choice doesn't have to be between epistocrats and populists. It doesn't have to be between very smart, educated people and strong men claiming to speak for the silent majority. There's this third option, which is people participating in politics on a regular basis.
Talking to Nicholas Tapio from Fordham University in New York, he's making the case for more citizen involvement, less reliance on experts in the way we run our government, federal and local, Nicholas. And I think, you know, that suspicion of the everyday person. I think of myself, you know, I'm a resident of a city. I don't know about the finer points of municipal bonding or sanitation management. I don't want me in charge of our wastewater system. Why should people count on me to be part of a decision like that, that I don't come in really knowing anything about?
Sure. So the thinking is in the modern world, you need experts. And so the question I'm interested in, what's the relationship between experts and ordinary people? And I realize it's a problematic distinction, but, you know, to stick with your example, somebody who knows a lot about water and waste and has that specialized training, and other people who don't, who are, you know, busy with other things. And one of the insights that I want to bring back into the conversation goes back to Thomas Jefferson, Alexis de Tocqueville, Carol Pateman, and they say, whenever there's an opportunity for people to be involved, you should try to get the people involved, right? So there's this temptation to just say, let's just put the experts in charge of everything and not bother people. And well, one thing is it becomes a vicious circle, right? Because why should people study waste management if their opinion doesn't matter at all? Why should people be involved with schools if their opinion doesn't matter at all? And maybe I can just explain one of the key examples for me.
Sure.
I think we're living in a moment where the federal government is really taking over more and more of the responsibilities for education. And that used to be almost an exclusively local thing. And it really wasn't until 1965, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, that you really saw this escalation of state departments of education and federal U.S. Department of Education after 1979, after it became a department level or cabinet level. And you know, that trend is just going to keep moving forwards. And I am really grieving the loss of powerful school boards. I think that's one of the when historians look back at the past 50, 60 years and they're trying to make sense of American politics, you've really seen the marginalization of school boards. And for me, those are one of the great sites of democratic activity. And when you've got so-called experts in Washington, D.C. and the nation and state capitals making all the decisions, parents are checking out of schools. They're like, who cares? Why am I gonna participate in the schools? And then they also don't want to participate in politics in general because they haven't gotten in the habit of participating.
Mentioning that year, 1965, makes me wonder what happens if that local empowered school board makes a decision to really heavily segregate their school district. That's part of why in education, the state and federal governments got more involved. Could this lead us at the local level, in some cases, down a bad path?
So maybe I can use this opportunity to pitch my book that I'm publishing in the spring of 2018 about the Common Core. And I have a chapter almost exclusively on that particular question. And I guess what I would say is too many people still think about education politics as if it's 1954, with Brown versus Board of Education, or 1965. And whereas people pose to me like, so Nick, do you want to go back in time to the 1950s when, you know, poor and minority children were not educated? I just want to go on the record. I don't want to go back in time. I'm not in favor of segregation. You know, the question that strikes me as the real one is, are we going to have a democratic future or a non-democratic future? And part of what I argue in my book is, listen, people in inner city Detroit, people in inner city Baltimore, people in inner city Chicago, they want a say in their children's education. And so education reformers who claim to be speaking for these people, they're not listening to the communities that actually want a meaningful say in how their children are educated. So for my view is that local control should be something in the suburbs, but it also should be in Title I schools or in historically disadvantaged communities.
So on a practical level, how would you recommend a school board or a local government, for that matter, start to maybe shake out of the old habits of not having citizens directly involved and start to reach out and actually listen?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, part of what you need to do is just convince people that it's their right and responsibility to speak up. And so I'm in New York, and we've got this really vibrant test refusal movement. And so that's actually been a wonderful activity to see democracy in action, because New York had very little say, or other states had very little say, about the Race to the Top program, or even, I would argue, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorization, the Every Student Succeeds Act. These were done in the nation's capital, you know, in boardrooms of billionaires foundations, in state capitals. The test refusal movement is a way to say, hey, listen, we're not happy. The shoe doesn't fit. You know, you might have thought you came up with these great plans, this really good shoe, but we're telling you the shoe doesn't fit. And so, you know, however people, however school boards, however state departments of education, however parents, however journalists can speak up and practice citizenship, that's one way to get the ball rolling.
We're talking to Nicholas Tampio, an associate professor of political science at Fordham University, looking at the role of experts in democracy and why he thinks everyday people need more of a voice. And the more of a voice they have, the more informed they'll be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we in the United States rely too much on experts when it comes to policy making? Do you worry that we've gotten less democratic, less representative of the will of the people? Do you personally feel alienated from the workings of government at the federal, state, or local level? Do you have an example where you think people are doing things differently for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation now with Nicholas Tampio, associate professor of political science at Fordham University. His piece in Eon is titled "Treat People as Citizens." He calls for everyday people, not experts, to steer democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we rely too much on policymakers, policy experts? Citizens are not involved in the process enough. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a very odd kind of question, but with more of the local governing being moved from the local municipalities, they don't have as much governance ability in the way of how the laws are being shifted and changed to be more county, but then more state regulation. So the locality, the local municipality boards and things are losing a lot of their governance power. So how do people fight that, being trying to get more involved in something other than their local need positions and volunteering and things, but actually getting into fighting back where they're just losing clout?
Gail, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, if I say the state has taken power away from my local government, why do I show up at the local town meeting, Nicholas?
So part of what I want to do with my work is just first give people confidence about why the local level matters. And I want to go back to the notion of Thomas Jefferson with these ward republics, with communities that make as many important decisions as possible, acknowledging that sometimes you need state and federal and sometimes international organizations, but as much as you can to have it local. And you know, I can't answer the specifics about that particular area because, you know, you need to figure out where in your circumstances you can move or push back. But one thing I would just tell people is recognize the wisdom of Federalist 51, which said the founders designed the Constitution for ambition to counteract ambition. That I would like to see more people at the local level having the confidence to fight back and actually fight back. So I don't know, you know, I don't know the specifics of your case, of this case, but, you know, I mean, things you can see like in New York are sometimes people write resolutions, local school boards write resolutions pushing back against the State Department of Education. So I don't know if there's something that's similar that could happen in Wisconsin where, you know, you just talk to people and you say, listen, we don't just simply have to follow orders from above. The Constitution was designed to give us some powers to raise our voice. Let's raise our voice.
Gail, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Paul in Lincoln County. Paul, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Interesting conversation, interesting guest. I am 71 years old. I'm living on a wooded portion of what was the small family farm I grew up on, northwest of Merrill. I'm also a county board supervisor, of one of 22, in a county that has a population of just under 30,000 people. And I realized from my county board experience that there are times when we need to consult and listen to the experts in various areas of county governance. And that's crucial, and that needs to happen. On the other hand, I'm old enough. I said I was 71. When I grew up, there were lots of little farms out in this rural area, and now there are none that are functioning. And when I was also a child, there were two one-room schools out here, both of which died as the small farms died. So my point here is that one also has to think of the demoralization that happens when the rural culture of small farms is destroyed, essentially, and consolidation occurs. And with that consolidation, as education moves to the city, as it has out here, the rural folks are left with a kind of a sense of alienation and resentment.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring in our guest because you brought up a lot of points there. Paul saying, you know, we lost our local small schools, are consolidated into bigger districts. It's further away and metaphorically and literally more distant to the people who rely on it, Nicholas.
Yes, well, I don't think you can look at any of these issues in isolation from one another. I don't think you can look at it economics or, you know, these political questions aside from economic questions, aside from intellectual questions. So, you know, we have to be active on many fronts. I'm sad to hear about the absence of local farms. You know, that was a great American tradition, and I'm sad that it's no longer as vibrant as it once was. In the progressive era, there was this massive consolidation of school districts, and you know, that argument is proceeding apace. There's an argument by this guy Mark Tucker from the National Center of Education and the Economy that our country should have 70 school boards, which would just be going even farther in the direction of consolidation. If you there's this woman who directs the Learning Policy Institute, Linda Darling Hammond, and she's in favor of a national ministry of education, right? So even going more in the direction of consolidation. You know, we have to go back to our tradition of an American political thought that says, listen, our country is unique among other countries in the world because we entrust ordinary people, because we empower teachers and principals and parents and children to run the school. So, you know, I'm not saying we have the wind in our back at this precise historical moment, but, you know, I think at the minimum we need to get clear that, like, listen, democracy is something worth fighting for. There's something valuable lost when we let so-called experts proceed independently of the will of the people.
Are we talking about here, in some cases, the process, Nicholas, is more important than the outcome? That, you know, sometimes we have to put up with a decision that we might not find admirable because that the process in and of itself is more valuable?
Yeah, that's right. Because, so I have a certain philosophy of how I would like my local school to be run, right? I myself like the John Dewey hands-on inquiry-based model. I have friends who like the more traditionalist model of let's read the classics and let's do the memorization and let's have a maybe in some cases even more religiously grounded education. So here's the choice. You can either just try to say, I want one model of education for the entire country, or you can say, listen, we're a big country and the Constitution doesn't enumerate education as a power. Let's let these debates take place all across the country. And, you know, the fact is you're going to have parents involved, teachers, superintendents. There's going to be yelling at meetings. There's going to be a lot of ill will. But you know what? That's okay, because you've got parents involved. And when you have parents involved, education's better. Community life is better. That's my view.
And Nicholas, briefly, as we wrap up, we argue right now about a lot of things in the country. What you're talking about doesn't seem to be at the top of the agenda. Are people listening to what you're talking about, trying to bring our government back to citizens and the local level?
I don't think I could have my energy unless I felt like enough people were listening. And, you know, in New York, I'll just stick to the example that's close to home. We've got this very vibrant test refusal movement, and parents are upset about what's happening, and this is an occasion where democracy is not an abstract concern, where it's actually, hey, listen, this is my kids, right? This is something that matters to me, and now I understand the purpose of democracy. Maybe our country made a mistake by placing too much trust on experts. So, I'm not going to say democracy is a raging fire in America in 2017. But it's still there, and I think we need to do everything we can to preserve it and maybe even make it a little bit more democratic.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Nicholas Tampio. He's an associate professor of political science at Fordham University. He's with us to talk about why he thinks relying too much on experts for political decisions is bad. We should be more democratic and trust citizens with more responsibility.